Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here, joined with Shad Marquitz. We are your hosts for this weekend show, and a big shout out to Shad throughout the middle to tail end of the week as I was away. Shad took over all the daily editorials and had some great commentary, so make sure you go back and listen to a lot of those daily editorials and even some of those focused on some stocks that our commentators like. We're going to get right into this show because we are kicking off the show with Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Advisory Group, also editor of the Book Report website. I will post a link within the weekend show posting to Peter's website, that Book Report, and that's where he breaks down all recent data and any key market moves that have his attention. Now, Peter, I read over every email that you send out through the Book Report, and I really want to start focused here on inflation. Look, you've been watching the data closely. You've had a very level-headed approach to just where inflation's going, and everybody has been throwing around that whole, is it transitory? Is inflation not transitory? We've seen a little pullback in some of those high inflation numbers that we had from months ago. Peter, break down what you think is important to understand about inflation and where you think it's going, please.
Well, services inflation, which is about 60% of core CPI, headline CPI, which is services inflation ex energy, that's never transitory. In the 20 years leading into COVID, that averaged 2.8% per annum of an increase. So the real debate is where does the good side of that inflation equation go to? And we are no question seeing a cyclical upturn in inflation on the good side. That's obviously filtered into the services side as well. And I'm not of the opinion that it just gets fixed so quickly, because it is so widespread, and because in particular transportation costs have gone up so much, and there's some secular factors that could keep transportation costs elevated. And the reason why I throw in that is because we know every single good that is produced in this world ends up on a truck, a ship, a plane, or a railroad. So if those prices stay elevated, that also embeds itself into the good side. So at some point things will be somewhat more normalized, but all you need is a couple of years of sticky inflation, persistent inflation of 3-4%, and that creates its own problems. It hurts growth as real wages fall. A world of negative interest rates, zero interest rates, and all this QE is certainly not a good backdrop for persistent inflation. And it also hamstrings, or handcuffs, I should say, the central bank's ability to continue on as they have been continuing on, in the sense that when inflation is low, you know, they feel they have license to do whatever they want at the pace they want. But if inflation becomes more of a problem, more of a challenge here, then that license may actually get taken away, and the market then possibly forces things upon the Fed.
Well, Peter, one of the things that we all know is that the government metrics don't really factor in all of the different areas of inflation. Some of the energy components, some of the way they calculate renters, and some of just the other areas, food, is not in there. But anybody that goes to a grocery store, anybody that goes out and buys something, can see inflation in their daily lives. But there's going to be a point where if inflation is sticky, and if it does stick around, that beyond the taper talks, they may have to start looking at tightening. But we all know if the Fed starts to tighten in this environment, they have such a huge balance sheet that it would be problematic. So how do you see that all squaring off?
Well, I think ending QE is going to be enough of a challenge for them. When I say challenge, it's obviously easy to do. You just pick a day when you're starting and you space it out. But difficult for them, because I don't know if they're going to have the guts to follow through with it. Because if the stock market, or I should say when the stock market falls in response to tapering, and I say when, not if, it's because every single correction of note outside of the Chinese yuan devaluation in 2015, and COVID coincided around the end of QE or tapering of QE in addition to rate hikes, do they have the intestinal fortitude and the guts to continue on in the face of a fall in the stock market? So I don't think that they're going to be thinking about raising rates until QE is done. I think one of the lessons they learned in 2017, 2018 was not to shrink your... Now, obviously ending QE is different than quantitative tightening where the balance sheet actually shrinks. The first thing the Fed's going to do is obviously maintain the level of their balance sheet when QE is over. And of course, that level is going to be much higher than the size of their balance sheet. But I think they are really focused on getting that done first before we talk about raising interest rates. But that also gets to the point of them being so far behind the curve here, is that here we have pretty aggressive inflation stats, which I think will continue, not necessarily at the same pace that we've seen, but at a much higher than a level than people are used to, that even when they're done with QE, rates are still going to be at zero. And yes, that will be at some point something that they're going to have to face. And like I said earlier, the direction of inflation will sort of assert that timeline for them rather than them doing it themselves. So to that point, the Fed may keep rates at zero as they end QE, but if the bond market is worried about inflation still, they'll tighten for them, which is essentially what we had in the first quarter of this year, is the market had a tantrum. It wasn't a taper tantrum because the Fed didn't tell us that they were changing policy yet. It wasn't a rate hike tantrum because the Fed obviously didn't tell us they were going to hike rates. It was a bond market that decided, you know what, inflation's an issue right now, and we're going to adjust. Now, granted, of course, yields have fallen because for a variety of reasons, but it was a sign that the bond market has no problem with sort of adjusting to where they think rates should be, irrespective of where the Fed wants them to be.
So, Peter, what do you think the Fed can handle in terms of higher inflation? Because in all fairness, before COVID, before all these new spending programs, inflation was still, for the most part, stuck under that 2% level that the Fed wanted. And the Fed was even saying, look, we're okay with inflation running hotter to average out some of those slower months and even years where inflation was under 2%. Now we're over 2%, and inflation's come back a little bit from some of those much higher readings at 5%+. How long do you think the Fed could withstand, say, 3 or 4% inflation?
Well, I think the question to answering that is how the bond market responds first, because the Fed tends to follow the market. And if the market starts to get really uncomfortable with persistent inflation and starts to adjust rates in the face of anything the Fed will do, the Fed will then follow suit. How they will follow suit, I'm not exactly sure, whether they would speed up the tapering or start talking about rate hikes. But I think they're going to actually take their cue from the market. They'll take their cue from inflation expectations and tips. They'll take their cue from the inflation questions in the confidence numbers, where real wages go, because that's the problem the Fed has, is we have a stagflationary type environment right now. And that is a central banker's worst nightmare. So I would call like policy right now is basically cross your finger type policy, that they're hoping and praying that inflation falls back down so they can sort of wrest control of a policy back into their own court, I guess you can say.
Well, Peter, one of the things you mentioned just a minute ago was that the bond market took it in its own hands to adjust rates the way they felt it should be, because the Fed is admittedly behind the curve. So one of the concerns a lot of analysts have is if this tapering moves forward, and we'll wait to see how it goes at Jackson Hole and at the September Fed meeting, but if they do start tapering and it's meaningful and they set up a timeline and they start going, if they go aggressively and they're not buying those bonds, right now they're spending $120 billion a month on bonds. If they dial it back to $90 billion and then $60 billion and then $30 billion, the question is who's going to buy those bonds? And if nobody is, rates will naturally, the 10-year and the 30-year will rise as a result of that, which would then potentially crimp some of these big moves we've seen higher in the markets. How do you think that plays into this factor of as they taper, it could actually cause a new taper tantrum down the road?
Well, interestingly, when they ended QE1 and QE2, and they tapered QE3, is yields actually fell. And when they initiated QE, yields actually rose, because the market interpreted it as, okay, QE on, let's steepen the curve, because that's reflationary of QE. But when QE stops, that's potentially contractionary, potentially could lead to a slowdown, so let's flatten the curve. So I'm not exactly sure how the long end will respond to the end of QE, because we still have U.S. banks that are potentially big buyers of treasuries. The U.S. government, while they're still selling an enormous amount of treasuries to finance the huge budget deficit of the U.S., that budget deficit should shrink this year compared to the last couple of years, or should say relative to, you know, the COVID time. So it's not as clear-cut as, okay, when the Fed is done, rates rise. When the Fed is doing this, rates fall, because we've seen counterintuitively reverse responses. I think the biggest influence on QE, well, no doubt it's monetizing the debt. So, yes, I mean, we do have to replace that. But even as they do taper QE, they're still going to be buying a lot of bonds for that time frame that they're going to be scaling back. And it's not as clear as where rates go when that happens. I think it's, and even it may not be clear when the Fed starts raising interest rates, because that may flatten the curve even more if people are worried about the growth implications of rate hikes.
What about globally too, Peter, when it comes to inflation data? What have you been noticing in terms of global inflation data and also central banks? We've had some of the smaller central banks already start to tighten and increase rates. Some of the larger central banks, so they do seem to be resisting that and using the Delta variant as a reason for that. How are you looking at the global picture here?
Well, it is interesting that many developing central banks who have a lot of experience with inflation have been raising interest rates. Brazil, Russia, Mexico, and others. Canada has been tapering QE. So I think that there has been, at least for some countries, Norway has hinted that they're going to be raising rates soon. South Korea said they're going to be raising rates soon. So there has been a response to the possibility of it. Now, wholesale inflation is a global phenomenon. Supply shortages is a global phenomenon. The cost of transportation and shipping skyrocketing is a global phenomenon. But from a consumer standpoint, different countries have had their own idiosyncratic ability to pass that on. Like, take Japan, for example. One of the things that's been keeping a lid on consumer price inflation in Japan, even though producer price increases have been pretty robust, is a 40% year-over-year decline in mobile phone fees. Well, that is a lot to do with government mandate and edict for those big declines. So it's also how they measure it. I mean, Europe measures the rent or housing component of inflation at a much smaller percentage than the U.S. And it's too low, and they're actually trying to readjust it. So they understate inflation if you would include housing prices, and housing prices in many parts of Europe have gone through the roof because of low interest rates. But I think overall the trend is higher when it comes to consumer price increases. And ironically, this is what central banks have rooted for, because they nonsensically root for higher inflation. And it'll be interesting to see how they respond to it once they get it.
Yeah, it's interesting that they were rooting for higher inflation for so long, and then they got there, and instead of taking a victory lap, they started talking it back down as transitory. But another component to the transportation is energy cost. And as energy costs, like we've seen what happened with oil and gas. You know, oil was negative last year at one point and very low. And then it's been in the 60s to 80s this year. So that's a huge component to inflation, because it affects how goods are shipped around the world, the input costs that companies have. And so that's a big pressure. But there's also the wage pressure that's growing. And so in addition to some of the hotter inflation metrics, we also have wages rising, not just in this country, but globally. And that kind of puts a cost push inflation scenario together, where you have rising prices mixed with rising wages. Do you think that's going to culminate into something where people have to address the inflation issue and admit that it may not be transitory?
I believe so. And to your point about wages, particularly on the leisure and hospitality side. Now we'll see how that plays out with Delta, even though I'm more confident that we'll be able to get in control of it. But there are labor shortages in many different parts of the market, and there's no question that wages are going up in certain sectors of the economy, maybe less so in others, but certainly in certain parts, and that then feeds into the whole inflation theme. Again, we're not going to run, inflation's not going to run the 7-8% annualized rate that we've seen so far this year. But even if it falls to 3-4, maybe even 5%, you know, that ends up being a serious problem. You know, unfortunately, most people in the markets were either a child in the 1970s, such as myself, or they weren't even alive in the 1970s. So they don't know anything of what sticky, persistent inflation looks like. They always assume that, hey, it goes up, it'll come right back down, and the Fed will do whatever they want to keep everyone happy. And I think we're potentially entering a situation where it's just not going to be that easy.
All right, Peter, let's switch over to some of the markets then. Let's start off with the U.S. equity markets because, look, even though we are seeing some extremely weak breadth, so just a few stocks, really a handful of the tech stocks and Tesla leading the U.S. markets higher and keeping them pretty much at all-time highs, we continue to see any short-term weakness bought, that whole buy-the-dip mentality, still very obvious for U.S. markets. Maybe it's just a sign of us being in summer and active traders not wanting to get too picky or active, but again, the broad averages staying at all-time highs. What do you think about the overall health of these U.S. markets?
Well, as you said, the breadth has been pretty crappy over the last couple of months, so you know, that's been a warning flag. But you know, for the broad indices, there's just an amazing resiliency and a desire to buy every single pullback. Now, if, and I emphasize if, the Fed follows through with tapering, and that begins in a couple months, then I think all that changes. I think the whole risk profile changes. But the market, you know, in a way, either doesn't believe that they're going to follow through, or if they do, who knows if they'll even make it through. So there's almost this like game of chicken right now between the stock market and even credit markets and the Fed tapering. I think that is quite a nonchalant attitude since, you know, the key reason why we're at these levels is because of QE and zero rates. But, you know, sometimes the market, a lot of times the market, at least over the last 10 plus years, has been very reactive rather than a discounting mechanism or proactive. So I think if Friday Powell said, you know what, yeah, Delta is a concern, but we're going to start tapering, where it lays the groundwork for wording of that kind in September, then you'll have a much different market on Friday than you have today. I know people are going to hear this weekend, but the point is that depending on what he says in Jackson, which he may not say anything, he may not want to commit ahead of the FOMC meeting a month from now, but if he does commit in one direction or another, my point is that the Monday rally could be different after he gives his speech.
Another point to consider is how much the foreign investment capital has flowed into the United States general markets because there's been weakness abroad. We can look to China and see how their regulatory pressures, particularly in their tech sector, has really hammered their markets down. And a lot of investors are fleeing some of those areas that have not been performing as well overseas and are using the U.S. markets as their safe haven, in a sense, or even flooding into the dollar. We saw some strength in the dollar over the last week. What do you make of that phenomenon, and could that be another tailwind for the U.S. markets?
I don't know. I'm always skeptical of calling flows as a factor to move markets, because for every foreign buyer of U.S. stock, there's somebody selling that stock to them. So for every dollar that goes in, it's a dollar going out. If you look at the U.S. Treasury market, foreigners have been reducing their exposure for years. They used to own half the U.S. Treasury market. Now they own about a third. And every time they buy a U.S. stock, they have a choice of whether they want to take the dollar currency risk or hedge it out. You know, from a valuation perspective, it was the last 10 years that the U.S. market performed so incredibly well against everybody else. And if anything, to me, there are more attractive opportunities outside the U.S. when you look out over the next 10 years. So, yeah, maybe foreigners do come here, but if they're deciding now for the first time to come here, I think it would be a bit too late.
Where are you seeing some of those opportunities outside of the U.S. then, Peter?
Notwithstanding what's gone on in China over the past couple months, beginning with the crackdown on Ant and Alibaba, I think that Asia, emerging markets in Asia, to me, and even some of the developed like Japan and Singapore, are going to be really attractive markets. They're valued cheaply, and I think that's where the growth is going to be economically when looking out over the next decade. I also find the UK market pretty attractive. There are a lot of cheap energy, financial commodity names there, among others, REITs too. That market's sort of been left for dead ever since Brexit, and you get a good dividend yield. Now, granted, these are value-type situations, and the reason why the U.S. has so outperformed everybody else is because of the, obviously, the well-known big-cap tech companies that outside of China, the rest of the world doesn't necessarily have. But thinking from a valuation perspective, there's some pretty attractive ones. Japan is very attractive, I think, with a lot of top-notch companies with some of the best balance sheets in the world. So I think just relying on what worked over the last couple of years or the last 10 years may not work as well when looking out over the next couple of years and even the next decade.
Well, just finally shifting over to one more market, and that's the commodity sector. We had a pretty good run in many of the commodities earlier in the year. We saw base metals, you know, copper, nickel, zinc, lead, all heading higher. Oil had the nice recovery we discussed earlier. The precious metals have been under pressure most of this time period. But over the last month or so, maybe 2 months, we saw the commodity sector weaken again, and it kind of went back down to support. How do you see the setup moving forward in the commodity sector?
Well, to me, the sell-off was all about the Delta variant causing concerns about growth. So that resulted in the pullback in oil and certainly copper. Lumber sort of was its own asset class and had its parabolic move higher. But even with the pullback, it's still well above where it was pre-COVID. I do think we're in a commodity bull market. I think we've had years of underinvestment. I think if you look at the energy sector, you know, the last thing an oil CEO is thinking about doing is investing a lot in new projects because they see that many people in the world want to put them out of business. So you're going to see years of underinvestment in oil and gas, still pretty good demand over the next 10 years. And at least in the next couple of years, I think you're going to see persistently higher prices. Copper, there's been a lack of investment in new mines for years. And I think it's pretty clear the demand drivers going forward for copper. I think agriculture, I think China is now a major, major player in the demand for grains and row crops like corn and soybeans. And while at least the U.S. farmer is incredibly productive and has for years continued to increase the yield on their farms, I think that the voracious demand, particularly out of China, will offset that. And ag prices will continue to go higher. And I think there's a trade there. And precious metals, which this year has been a very frustrating year, I do think that it's in the context of a strong year last year, and also will get its legs going again when people realize that inflation is not so temporary.
Peter, what do you think about the underperformance of especially the precious metals stocks and the miners generating good revenue numbers? I understand that the argument can be that, well, their input costs are going up and the underlying metals prices have been drifting, and the market, well, it's a forward-looking instrument here, and it's been telling us that metals prices, especially gold prices, were going lower. Again, though, your thoughts on just the general underperformance of these majors that have much healthier balance sheets now?
They do, and robust earnings and cash flow, and I think it's the sector that's been left for dead for years. I think that people, like I said earlier, believe that inflation is transitory and that any uptick is going to be short-lived. And not many people believe in gold. They're more obsessed with Bitcoin. And it's just a group that has just been neglected in the face of some really good fundamentals. Now, granted, the mining business is tough, and there's not that consistency of earnings that you see quarter over quarter that people like to see when they buy Google or even Coca-Cola. But that's just the way it is. But, you know, as you say, even with higher costs, margins are still really big and really fat for these miners. And I think at some point when gold and silver, which they will, I believe, takes their next leg higher, the miners will get a lot more attention again.
So, Peter, let's wrap it up with just a general summary then in terms of the key markets you're watching, key data points. Now that we are progressing closer to the end of summer, we can assume the trading is going to pick up and maybe some new trends be established. What do you think is going to be important to watch as we move through, let's just say, the rest of this year?
Well, bottom line is what's the Fed going to do with QE? And where does inflation go from here? Because they may want to sit on their hands with QE until they get a better comfort level with COVID. But if inflation is going to continue to run hot through year end, which I expect it to, and certainly into 2022, then that may force the Fed's hands. And the last thing the Fed wants to do is be forced to react to things rather than doing it on their own volition and timeline. So to me, it's all about inflation. Are we in stagflation? I think we are. Will it continue? I think it will. And what that means for Fed policy.
All right. So inflation and Fed, still the keys that we need to be watching for. I'm with you, Peter, but boy, oh boy, the Fed has started telling us that they are, well, thinking of tightening here, but or at least winding down the QE program. We'll see if that actually happens. Peter, it's always great chatting with you. Thank you for taking time on this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend, and I look forward to chatting with you again in a little while.
Thanks, guys. You too.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And in this segment, after those first few with Peter Buchvar, we're featuring a replay from late in the week when Shad chatted with John Fenech, portfolio manager and owner of Fenech Consulting. They go through a number of resource stocks, mostly juniors, that you should have your eyes on. I hope you all enjoy this interview. The full interview was also posted on Friday on our site.
Hello, and welcome into the KE Report. I'm your host, Shad Markowitz, and I'm joined with portfolio manager John Fenech of Fenech Consulting. John, I want to kick things off today with the news out of Jackson Hole, where Jerome Powell has moved the goalpost once again on tapering. A lot of the Fed governors and other Fed mouthpieces wanted to see the tapering start immediately. They wanted to see it start in September. It looks like now that's going to be pushed back to November and December at the earliest. So that news has sent gold up sharply. It's sent the markets up. It's generally been not a surprise, but an admission that maybe the growth wasn't quite so rosy and maybe the economy wasn't quite as strong as many believe. So what do you make of this news today out of Jackson Hole from Jerome Powell?
Sure. Thanks for having me on, Chad. It's affecting markets in a positive way because, you know, many were expecting Powell to talk about tapering here today in a way to set up the September 22 Fed meeting, right? And that was also articulated, as you said, from Fed, you know, governors like Bullard from St. Louis, Kaplan from Dallas, like all these guys in the last couple of days have been talking about the need to do this in September. What's interesting is that the average client doesn't take the time to go to the Fed website and realize that Kaplan and Bullard don't even vote this year. So who cares? You know, it's like the guy who matters is Powell. And so I've been telling my clients, focus on this only, this speech at 10 Eastern, because what he says matters, right? So I got out of it that we're looking at November now, not September, which gives, you know, mining and metals investors a huge runway here. I mean, don't forget that three of the biggest conferences in our sector, Shad, are coming up. So September 8th through the 11th is Precious Metal Summit in Beaver Creek, Colorado. You've got Denver Gold September 12th through the 14th in Denver. And then you've got Brian London's conference in New Orleans around October 19th. So a lot of money is going to be, you know, thrown around. And I use the guarantee word never, and I'll use it right now. I guarantee you CEOs are going to be at these conferences talking up their real results, and it's going to get some action here in September. So to answer your question, we've been buying in advance of this. You know, we've taken a position that is not popular, I guess, when I look at my peer group, you know, and the newsletter writers who have been talking about, you know, gold being a magnet to 1560 or 1677. I mean, that gap that we saw down to 1676 or so on that Monday was completely bought here and then some. So, like, to me, that was what I was telling clients, follow gold because it's going to matter, and then the miners will follow.
That was a great call, John, and it absolutely mattered today. We've seen a nice bounce in gold. It looks like we're going to put in a nice weekly close, which is a good thing, a nice daily green candle, but it's also significantly above that 1750, 1760 level. People were concerned about that. Was resistance, now it's support,
right?
And we're well on the way in the 1800s here. Another takeaway from this Fed talk today with Powell that you had mentioned to me off mic, I'd love to get your thoughts on it a little bit further, is how the reopening trade may have gotten a little bit ahead of itself with some of the different hospitality sectors. So speak to me a little bit about that. You had some great comments off mic.
So I have cruised over 25 times. I've been fortunate enough to stay in over 2,000 unique hotels over my career. I've traveled a ton, and I can tell you that, like, think about it, right? If you're an executive like me and you need connectivity to trade, are you going to lock yourself on a cruise ship right now? Are you kidding me? Like, the look what happened in Asia where you're stuck for weeks, like at port even. You can't get off the ship because some people have COVID. It's like, no, I'm not going to put myself in that position. There's no way I'm doing that for months probably, right? But that's from doing it 25 times and enjoying it, right? Like, so what does the average person think, right? I mean, I think cruise ship stocks are very vulnerable. It's not something we've shorted yet, but we're definitely tracking. Another area is hotels. And I've stayed in over 2,000 hotels, as I just mentioned. And these are, you know, the Marriotts and the Hyatts of the world, very good brands. But when you ask the manager at the desk, what's your capacity tonight? And they're like 20% or 40%. I mean, how is that in line with Powell's comment today, which was, you know, quote, hotels and airlines are back to pre-pandemic levels? Are you kidding me? Like, are you kidding? Seriously, like, there's no way that capacity is back to these levels. If you ask the average hotel manager, they have cut, you know, housekeeping by 25 to 50%. Their restaurants are closed. Their bars are closed. Their gyms are closed. Their lounges are closed. Yet the prices are the same. So at some point, the average client says, I'm not doing this anymore, right? Like, this is ridiculous. How are you pricing me out of the market, Mr. Hotel Manager? You know, it's like not fair to the average consumer, and we're looking to short some hotels as well.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting that just a few months back, if we dial it back, everybody was thrilled about the reopening trade. We are back to normal. And now with all the Delta variant concerns and certain cities and certain areas starting to lock down and rental cars, hotels, and airlines and cruises having gotten way ahead of themselves on what they were pricing people, I think they're finding out that the future wasn't as rosy as they were hoping for. And the Fed acknowledged that today by moving the timeline back and kicking the can down the road a little bit. So it's boosted the gold price. It's definitely helped the miners today. But still, overall, John, over the last year, a lot of the miners are down substantially, 30, 40, 60%. So there's some great opportunities out there. I know you follow the sector like a hawk, and you're always watching for good risk-reward opportunities. What are you seeing out there when you look at the mining stocks, and then what are you doing in your portfolio?
Sure. So I'll go through a couple different metals here. First, let's choose gold. Gold would be U.S. gold. USAU is our top gold holding right now. You just had Ed Carr on your show not too long ago, right? So Ed had some comments about the Copper King opportunity. I actually toured that in June in Wyoming with Ed. I was very impressed. I came back to my clients around $10 and said, this thing is going much higher. It has dropped all the way down to, I think, $9.15 here this week, where we were buying the low there. We bought again today at the $9.34 level, and the stock is currently at $9.43. So we think that stock has tremendous upside at $9.43. We think, you know, to define tremendous in the near term, I would say within 30 days, this could be up 20%. I mean, like, that's how bullish we are on the stock, because there is no float. There's 7 million shares out. I can account for 4 million of those shares, and most of those guys aren't selling. So what do you have, a $3 million share public float? Show me another gold stock with a 3 million share public float. I don't even know of anything close to that, right? So this stock has tremendous torque, and it trades on the NASDAQ, so we like the liquidity. Another name would be Fury. I had lunch with Ivan Bebek, the chair, here about 10 days ago. And Ivan is very bullish. Despite the move down in shares here, he did what he had to do with removing the CEO and bringing a new one in. He put out a note to shareholders about a week ago that I thought was very well written. And when you look at the stock here today, we were big buyers at 73.5 because there looked to be a huge short covering just around 73-ish. I mean, biggest volume I've seen on the stock in terms of short covering in a while. And I think that that is going to bode well here. It's trading at 74 as we speak. And, you know, my target is easily over $1 in the next couple of months because they have news coming like so many other mining companies. Another name in gold and silver would be Fabled, FBSGF. Fabled has a catalyst in the near term as well, in that they are working with the Toronto Exchange right now to talk about a spinoff of their copper assets. So for every 5 shares you buy of FBSGF, you're going to get 1 share of Fabled Copper here, most likely if the spinoff is approved, which we think it will be. So does the CEO, Peter. So, you know, I think that's tremendous value, right? At 11.4 cents, it's like you're going to get 2 for 1 pretty much if you buy enough of the gold and silver play, which, by the way, came out with amazing drill results here on a property that I'm very familiar with called Santa Maria just about a week ago. So, you know, they continue to expand that resource, and I know Peter is very excited about the results. Shifting to silver, I would say Aftermath Silver looks to be completely bombed out here. AAGFF is the ticker. They will have news most likely in the next 30 days as well. You know, we've talked about this offline, Chad, but, you know, the exploration companies are more exciting to some than a development company. But at 33 cents, I mean, everyone loved the stock at $1.30 plus, and now it's at 33 cents, guys. I mean, why not put a bid out there, right? It's like this stock is not going out of business. They are a tremendous producer. They're going to be a tremendous producer or get bought by someone within the next few years, and, you know, in markets that are, you know, a little bit less favored right now, Chile and Peru. But who cares at 33 cents is my thought. You know, it's like Michael and Ralph know what they're doing. They're cashed up enough at this point, and they're economic at $17 silver, both projects, right? So, like, unlike so many that have higher AISCs to be profitable, this is going to be profitable at very low silver prices. Another that is our favorite silver pick is AUMN. I've publicly gone after people like Taylor Dart and just questioned his methodology on Seeking Alpha because he has not talked to the CEO ever. So Warren Rain has basically told me, like, yeah, I don't know who this person is. I've reached out to him on email and I've reached out to him on phone, and we'd love to have a conversation, and he just hasn't replied to date. So he was saying at 44 cents, the stock looked, you know, like it was there's better value out there. Well, hey, it's gone from $1.30 to 44 cents. Show me some better value in silver, you know, outside of like Aftermath and AUMN, and I'm all ears. You know, there's probably some names out there that I'm missing, but, you know, this is another stock that trades very well. It trades on the NYSE Lights. And Warren has a plan in place, right? Like, when you look at the stock, Chad, back in 2015, the stock exploded higher based on Velardania going back into production. Guess what's happening in October of this year? They're going to decide if Velardania goes back into production or not. And if they say yes, I'm not expecting like an explosion, but I'm expecting a lot of people to cover their short interest, which, by the way, has probably doubled over the last month. So, you know, I think the stock looks very, very good here at 47 cents. Shifting to industrial metals, just another minute here. I guess palladium is something that I've wrote on for Sprott and have a lot of passion for. Canadian palladium is my favorite pick right now, which is DCNNF. DCNNF is run by a guy named Wayne Tisdale. Wayne was the person responsible for Rainy River over at New Gold, which is their largest mine currently. So on an 8-cent palladium stock, I'm seeing tremendously good results coming out of their project in Canada. They've got other assets as well. And, you know, the stock was at 15 cents here this summer. It's pretty much been halved. So, you know, we're buying a lot of that at 8 cents. Another palladium name that I think has news coming is Group 10. And they've telegraphed this publicly. That ticker is PGEZF. I like Mike Rowley a lot as the CEO. Their rocks are literally adjacent to Sibanye's in Montana. Sibanye is SBSW. If you want to, you know, if your listeners want to check that out, they have a real mine called Stillwater. I've been invested in that mine for many years. got bought by Sibanye, and guess who's right next door, Group 10. So when they come out with their report here over the next few weeks, I think it'll open some eyes.
That's a great list of companies, John. And just in full disclosure, I am also a shareholder of U.S. Gold Corp. And we did just have Ed on the show. I'm a shareholder of Fury Gold, and we have Ivan on regularly. I'm not a shareholder of Fabled Silver, but I am of Golden Minerals, AUMN, that you mentioned. And they have a net smelter agreement on that Santa Maria project.
Right.
And then I'm also a shareholder of Group 10. So so we have a lot of common ground there. And we have Mike on the show fairly regularly as well. So that's a great list of companies. And all the companies you mentioned are worth investors checking out. Just real quick as we wrap up, John, maybe spend 60 seconds and talk to us about how Finnick Consulting works and how investors could get value if they wanted to contact you.
Sure. So we work with investors of all sizes. I don't draw the line in the sand at $1 million like some money managers do. We don't, you know, work directly with them in the sense that we're not managing their money, but we're providing daily alerts. And by that, I mean 5 to 6 emails a day of real-time alerts. Like, I just bought Fury at 73 cents. I saw a big short covering. This is possibly the low. So I'll say those kind of things right alongside my trade for someone, you know, within 5 minutes, right? So like, it's very valuable information, I think, because it's not like a newsletter writer where it's weekly, right? I mean, a week in this market is an eternity, in my opinion. We do have a newsletter, by the way, that we just started, because I want to try to reach some of those lower asset-based clients, Chad, where, you know, a lot of people with 100K, 200K, 50K, 10K, they don't have maybe the money to buy into the alert system. So we start them on the newsletter, and then we'll graduate them down the road into the alert system when markets recover. But yeah, that's what we do. We try to do portfolio reviews for people. You know, we're not a licensed RIA or an advisor, but we basically have a lot of knowledge in the space. So, you know, just as an example, a $11 million client came to me with a Troy list recently at a buck this summer, right? And I said, you know, I think they're going to do a financing, and I think you should sell it. And it's trading at 65 cents yesterday now. So like, we can provide, I think, a lot of advice and help to clients because we're talking to CEOs all day long. So I talked to, you know, 18 CEOs this week. I'm constantly on the phone with people trying to get, you know, some type of edge. And I think that's valuable.
Absolutely. Well, we appreciate you sharing your thoughts with us here at the KE Report. And if anybody's interested in reaching out to John, you can email him. What's your email address, John?
Yeah, sure. It's J-O-H-N and then a dot and then my last name, Fennick, F-E-N-E-C-K at yahoo.com.
Okay, great. And if anybody has any questions for us or wants to reach out to us to get in touch with John, you can email Corey at fleck@kereport.com or myself at shad@kereport.com. John, always a pleasure having you on, and good luck out there in the markets.
Thanks, Shad. Take care.
Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Here we are wrapping up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. In this segment, I am going to replay a company update that took part earlier this week. It was from GR Silver Mining on the back of a new resource estimate at the Plomosas project. Look, there were a lot of good interviews and company updates that we had this week, so please be sure to go back through the week and click on those company updates and let us know what you think of each and every one of those companies and if you have any follow-up questions for those companies. Everyone, I hope you enjoy this final segment, and I hope you all have a great weekend. Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. I'm getting one quick daily editorial out before I step away for the rest of the week. And this daily editorial, it's a pretty important update coming from GR Silver Mining. Traded on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol GRSL and on the OTCQB under the symbol GRSLF. I'm chatting with the president and CEO, Marcio Fonseca. Now, Marcio, following up on the news release that came out just yesterday, August 23rd, it is the initial resource estimates at the Plomosas project in Mexico. Now, just to bring everybody up to speed, this resource encompasses a few different areas on that Plomosas project, the Plomosas mine area and the San Juan area. I'll post figure 1 from that news release below below this interview so you can see first and foremost where the resources that the company has are. And remember that San Marcial down in the south, that resource came out, I believe, last year. And now we're adding San Juan and the Plomosas mine area to the resource list. And all these black labels are new targets that the company is going to drill. Now, Marcio, we talk about the resource here. It came in at indicated just over 10 million ounces silver equivalent and inferred 21 million ounces silver equivalent. So a total of about 31 million ounces here of silver equivalent. Marcio, give us a rundown of this resource. Did it match expectations? What should investors note about this resource announcement?
Thanks, Corey. It matched expectations. The street or analysts were trying to, they were quoting that we will get close to 80 million ounces of silver equivalent. So you get 79 plus a little bit. But it's a major milestone for the company. We did in 9 months what nobody, other companies which controlled this project for 20 years did. We revealed 563 drill holes, validated 476 of those. Integrated with more brand new 80 drill holes surface underground, put everything in a good geological 3D model, discovered gold and silver in some areas that were not really drilled before. And we came across some challenges, but dealing with historical data, sometimes you come with some unsampled intervals or no core available. We dealt with that and put all together and create this initial resource, which together with the San Marcial project that's next to the Plomosas project. Now we get close to 79 million ounces, and you can integrate all this in a single project altogether.
Now, just to remind everybody, San Marcial, that is 48 million ounces silver equivalent. So that's where you get that almost 80 million ounces silver equivalent together. Marcial, let's talk about some of the historic drill core that you use. You said you validated over 530, I believe, and a total of 476 were brought into this resource. What can you tell us about the work that was done on those historic holes and how it played into this resource?
Yeah, from the historical holes, we had the Grupo Mexico and First Majestic. Those are the most important ones. The First Majestic, we have the core. That means, great, you have QAQC, you have everything. The historic, you have all the documentation, all the paperwork, and very isolated core. So it means we have all the assays from certificates for a lot of the holes, but we didn't have the core to go back and sample areas that were not sampled before. And we want to do that, but we didn't have the core. Why we want to do that? Because with our drilling and reviewing the First Majestic drill holes, we identified areas inside the mine that Grupo Mexico drilled and did not sample, meaning that we could add more mineralization to the resource. But unfortunately, as part of the compliance with 43-101 guidelines and also to be using the best practices and standards doing resource estimation, the QP made a good decision that was to assign a zero value for unsampled intervals. That means when you have high-grade material and brand new drill holes nearby and you have a zero in a drill hole next by, you're going to average that. So that overall reduce your grade. But we believe with a little bit of more drilling, we are going to be able to really upgrade or prove the upside in the silver grade and gold grade in this area, Plomosas mine, and so on.
So you don't have any of that old drill core, right? That's why you can't go back and resample it?
Yeah, that's right. We discovered that when we bought the project. We thought we'd be able to go around and try to, just with some validation drill holes. We did some twin holes, and we proved that the mineralization is wider and more constant in those intervals. But from a geostatistical point of view, the QP is of the opinion that he must assign a zero there. And he did. Okay?
So what's the follow-up work going to be then? Do you simply just drill almost twin holes to some of these just to bring that grade in? Because I'm guessing that with a zero value, that's bringing down the grade and probably the overall ounces as well.
That's right. So that brings the opportunity for upside. It's a very conservative resource, initial resource model. But it's important for the audience to understand that at the time when Grupo Mexico was drilling, most of the holes were drilled from the surface, 500 meters drill hole, 600. So they didn't have the mine. Now we have the mine, so we can go underground and drill 20, 30 meters drill holes in some very specific locations to be very surgical, you know, to try to really pinpoint some areas. And we can do that very quick and continue to upgrade the resource and continue the drilling on surface is what we are doing, drilling.
Now, when it comes to the grade in this resource, in the indicated category, the grade is about 133 grams per ton silver equivalent. In the inferred category, 113 grams per ton silver equivalent, made up of a number of different metals. There is a gold component here, silver component, also lead and zinc. Take us through the grade component and how that potentially compares to other assets and other potential mines.
For sure. Another positive surprise for us, that even with the zeros in the estimation, we end up with 60% of the silver equivalent being related to precious metals, which is a big number, and we believe it can increase. With other mines in the same district in New Mexico, we are not that far away when you talk about the Plomosas Brecha, because that's a polymetallic, but we can have the silver and gold as a component. What's really important here, and for the audience, if they can look at the figure number 2 in the news release, is that we had some hits in gold only, no lead and zinc, almost nothing, in some subvertical zones outside of the resource. That means we did not include these hits there because there are still some isolated holes. And we believe now that we can have a gold model that we are drilling at Plomosas South, which is a step out from the Plomosas mine area resource.
So then when it comes to all the drilling that is underway, and look, there's also, I understand, a lot of drill cores still in the labs. Where are the drills going? Where are they now? What do investors need to focus on as you move forward from this resource?
Yeah, from the second half of the, almost we are probably inside the second half of 2021, is about drilling. We announced the 14,000 meters of drilling, surface and underground. Underground because we have a drill rig now at San Marcial inside the tunnel to expand that resource and discover more mineralization, because important for the audience, we just completed this massive ground geophysical survey, a lot of new anomalies, and connecting San Marcial all the way to San Juan. And all the drill holes to the north on the figure 1, you see the Plomosa South, Trampolin, Loma Dorada, El Saltito, and the gap area. It's concentrating on silver gold structures or veins, trying to continue to hit high grade silver gold veins in the project, Plomosa's project.
Okay, Marcio, remind everybody the cash in the bank for the company and also what the budget is or what you intend to spend as you move through the rest of this year with all the drilling.
So the budget right now is $8.8 million, and the budget was approved probably close to $2.5 million. But let's see how if the market comes back and how we continue. But we've been drilling at not really expensive drill holes and more shallow at the moment in the surface holes. That help us. And might still end up very good in cash position by December and have money for next year.
Now, again, going back to this figure one where you outline where the resources are and also these other targets, what are you excited about in terms of some of these other targets and all of these other kind of vein systems that you either have identified or that are inferred?
I'm excited about because the Plomosas mine geology, what we learned, has been a school for other geologists to understand why Grupo Mexico was biased towards the zinc and lead. And we can find more and more in these projects. For example, the Trampolin that's just between San Juan and Plomosas is a parallel zone. Never drilled. We are going to drill that. And we believe we can continue to find veins that are attractive. No? And the resource is done on the concept of what can be potentially amenable for open pit and underground. So some of these areas can be or not. So it's going to be a very interesting evolution for the company.
All right. Absolutely. Marcio, thank you for taking time. Quite shortly after that news was announced, in full disclosure, I am a shareholder of GR Silver Mining. If anybody has any follow-up questions regarding the resource or any of the drilling that's ongoing, please email me, fleck@kereport.com, and I will get Marcio to address those. Marcio, thanks again for your time. Have a great rest of your week.
Thank you.